Hi there. Welcome back to Environmentalism Now. I'm your host, Tony Bocchetti, and today we're going to be taking a look at one of America's most hotly contested environmental issues, the digging of natural gas wells that make use of hydraulic fracturing to access U.S. natural gas reserves, a process colloquially known as fracking. For the sake of scope, today we'll be investigating fracking specifically in the Ohio River Valley region. Before we begin discussing the implications of fracking in the context of environmentalism and competing interests, let's first examine the process and history of modern hydraulic fracturing itself. Fracking is a process by which a material called a proppant, usually a mixture of acidic fluid and sand, is pumped at high pressures along horizontally drilled wells. The stimulation caused by the proppant creates cracks in the rock that assist in the collection of natural gas. This unconventional method of drilling allows energy companies to access reservoirs of oil and natural gas that were previously considered either impermeable or unprofitable to access. Funnily enough, modern hydraulic fracturing was made viable partially by accident. In 1949, oil giants Halliburton, the company that former Vice President Dick Cheney was CEO of from 1995 to 2000, patented the first process that could be defined as hydraulic fracking, a process that consisted of pumping a mixture of napalm and sand into stone formations in order to more easily access oil. However, the modern process that we see today was stumbled upon in the 1980s, when Mitchell Energy engineers observed that a malfunction with the proppant caused it to be less viscous and more water-like than previous iterations of the more gel-based proppants. Deciding to wait and observe the effects of the malfunction, the engineers observed promising results, and modern fracking was born. While this process allows access to more natural gas than we know what to do with, fracking poses a whole new litany of problems whenever it comes to environmental impact. The fluid that is used to create and widen the cracks in the shale layer, the very cracks that allow fossil fuels to be collected, include radioactive materials, heavy metals, hydrocarbons, and salts. After it's used in the fracking process, this wastewater poses a grave environmental risk in its disposal, which includes on-site dumping, placement in deep wastewater wells, or distribution into water decontamination facilities. These processes, but on-site dumping and wastewater wells in particular, can contaminate aquifers and local drinking water, and contamination can also occur due to any incidents or negligence during any stage of the fracking process. There are also worries about fracking's polluting effects on the air. While the majority of fracking endeavors are in pursuit of natural gas, which releases about half as much carbon as coal, the fracking process itself disperses methane, an extremely toxic greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. Finally, fracking raises many concerns over water usage. Any given fracking well will use 3 to 6 million gallons of water over its lifetime. And while this is a relatively low amount of water consumption with respect to other industrial-level uses in our society, such as agriculture and power plants, it can have a significant impact on local water supply when it's shouldered by communities that are not normally equipped for such high levels of water use. Additionally, water used in fracking processes is permanently removed from the water cycle of the surrounding environment, as it becomes far too contaminated to be allowed back in the system. This reality increases the ecological footprint of the water that is used for hydraulic fracturing. Regardless of these environmental concerns, fracking has experienced a massive boom in prevalence in the Ohio River Valley in recent years. In 2000, only 7% of the oil and natural gas that was produced in the United States originated from fracking, but as of 2019, that figure has shot up to 67%.
Basically, 2009, 2010 is when it kind of took flight, and it was in kind of full flight in 2012 and 2013, just kind of all over the place. Mm. You know, hundreds of drill rigs everywhere, lots of man camps, lots of, you know, fracking and trucks all over the place, all over from, you know, State College all the way into Ohio.
That was Dr. Ted Auk, the Great Lakes program coordinator for a nonprofit called Frack Tracker Alliance. He described to me how quickly the companies made their home in the valley, promising economic development, jobs, repaved roads, and crucially, direct financial compensation for land rights. He also noted the fact that these energy companies routinely commit money in the form of token donations to community projects. And this is something that I've heard echoed in my interviews with residents of Washington and Allegheny counties, which is a hotspot for the fracking boom and, coincidentally, my hometown. One resident described donations from Range Resources, the energy giant presiding over the development of fracking industry in the area, to the city mission. Another mentioned contributions to the local fire department, and yet another described scholarship programs that help a select few residents from the two counties attend college every year. For many of these residents, all of whom I interviewed were staunch conservatives, these small community investments, along with rhetoric of possible energy independence from the Middle East, were enough for them to accept fracking and its possible dangers with open arms. And this contributed massively to the growth of the industry. That is, until 2015.
In like 15 and 16, the price of oil and by association gas plummeted, and the industry in turn lowered its activity.
However, the collapse in gas and oil prices that Dr. Alk mentions did not kill the industry in the Ohio River Valley by any means, instead just making their operations more inconsistent and involved in a more volatile boom-bust cycle. How did all of this turn out, you might ask? Unfortunately, the answer is not good. Despite the assurances and promises from energy companies like Range Resources, the realities of the presence of fracking in these communities is overwhelmingly negative. While direct contributions like land rights compensation and the community investment I mentioned previously do make some waves in the lives of the citizenry, it is clear that these investments are not attempts to better the communities that are affected by the industry. Instead, they're ways of placating the population in order to keep them receptive to the ongoing activities in the area. These actions also help energy companies cover themselves ahead of time for possible accidents or negligence, two realities of the fracking industry that one of the residents I interviewed admitted, almost reluctantly, have indeed occurred. Additionally, the promise of jobs and economic growth ultimately went unanswered as well. Again, here's Dr. Alk.
A lot of the labor that's coming in isn't organically generated within Pennsylvania or Ohio or West Virginia. It's coming from other places, and it leaves just as fast as it came in.
In addition, much of this seasonal labor is also not unionized, another policy of the industry, and is therefore extremely unstable for the locals who do manage to find work on the wells. The economic development that has accompanied the rise of the fracking industry is also extremely volatile. Much of the stimulation in local economies is also linked with a large influx of outside labor. For example, commercial businesses like restaurants and grocery stores are built and experience sporadic boosts of cash whenever outside labor comes to work. But then these businesses are left underattended whenever the population of the towns descend back to their normal levels. On top of all this, the idea that investment in the fracking industry would give the United States unprecedented levels of energy independence, a universally cited positive amongst the citizens I interviewed, was never anything more than a fabricated public opinion ploy propagated by the industry. The fracking industry produces much more than is necessary for home consumption, and accordingly, is involved in selling large amounts of fossil fuels to foreign entities, as well as allowing foreign direct investment to be involved in all steps of the industry. According to a paper co-authored by Dr. Alk, Dr. Eve Brotman, and Dr. Brian Stinchfield, this exchange of dependence on foreign fossil fuels for dependence on foreign investment creates a whole new set of negative security externalities for the United States, as well as introducing more forces that infringe upon the democratic rights of the communities involved in the production of fracked oil. The unfortunate realities of the actions of the fracking industry are replicated in communities that do not welcome them with open arms as well. There is one difference here, though. In this case, they just really aren't shy about it. Through cooperation with the government, oil companies are given utility status, and therefore the power of eminent domain, which allows them to appropriate and develop on private property without the consent of the landowner, just as long as the landowner receives what the government considers, and I'm using air quotes here, just compensation. This leaves many citizens, many of whom value their land far more than any money could buy, standing on their doorsteps with broken hearts and spirits. But at least they have a check in their hand as a reward. Land agents trained to coerce citizens in any way possible engage in bully tactics and intimidation against those who don't sign the ultimately meaningless consent papers. They threaten that any resistance will be met with the lowering of the amount given as compensation, and they routinely lie about their intents and actions. So right about now is when a lot of you are probably wondering, how does this business that operates almost like a mob with no regard for truth or anything resembling honest business practices allowed to operate with impunity? Where's the large-scale response from the very biggest environmental NGOs to this obvious and pervasive environmental banditry? Well, unfortunately, it's not coming, and it won't be anytime soon. This is due to the fact that in order to be more attractive to larger pools of donors, Big NGOs are busy crafting and lobbying for initiatives that ultimately will be as useful in addressing the climate emergency as trying to use a colander as a bucket. They often focus on market solutions that can be described as low-hanging fruit, or solutions that are easy to pursue, because they don't stir the pot too terribly much, and there is a relatively uncontested path to their realization. These initiatives include individual citizen emission regulation, caps on emissions, and regulations on air quality that can be bought or sold by large companies like stocks, and others. We won't be able to look to them to help to untangle the mess of laws and government cooperation that allow the democratic rights of citizens as well as the environment to be infringed with impunity by a trillion-dollar industry. This work will be difficult, run up against myriad institutional roadblocks, and will most certainly not be low-hanging fruit. But according to Dr. Alk, hope isn't lost. Smaller, more locally responsive nonprofits, not unlike his own, have not given up the fight. Frack Tracker works to provide accurate and complete information on the activities and impacts of the fracking industry, among other things, for anyone who needs it. To speak on the significance of his work, here's Dr. Alk again.
It's an industry that's been bullying people, and they've been bullying the communities by way of elected officials and just rigging the regulations by way of information asymmetry. So what that means is basically they have all the information, all the data, all the automation, they have all the tools and the toys, and communities have none of it. So the best way to level that and put your thumb on the scale is by way of data, bringing the data to the people so that their activism is informed. Because at the outset in 2010, 11, for a long time, the activism, the anti-fracking activism, was driven by emotion, which is, you know, but it was entirely driven by emotion. So it's become more and more driven by science and by empiricism. So quantitative rather than qualitative activism.
Dr. Alk also noted and praised the work of much smaller scale, often specific issue focused activist groups, saying that they are, quote, committed, authentic, and stubborn. I was fortunate enough to be able to sit down with one such activist, Melinda Clatterbuck. Melinda, who is a preacher, lover of the environment, and mother of two, is one of the co-founders of the group Lancaster Against Pipelines and sits on the board of the PA Community Rights Network. She first became involved in activism in March of 2014, when an oil company land agent came to her door and asked to survey her land in order to plan the construction of a proposed pipeline, a project that would mar her beautiful 8-acre tract completely without her consent. Indeed, it was Melinda herself who first informed me of the legal acrobatics the oil companies engage in with respect to eminent domain. Unlucky for the oil companies, she refused to simply accept the fact that a company based in Oklahoma had more rights concerning her land in Pennsylvania than she did. Unfortunately for Melinda, this meant simultaneously trying to work against the wishes of both the trillion-dollar industry and her own government. Melinda Clatterbuck doesn't like to think of herself as an activist, but instead is simply a responsible community member who's taking steps to protect the well-being of herself, her family, her neighbors, and her world. Here she is describing her work.
We did nonviolent civil disobedience. We, as a community and as a movement, decided that we were going to be committed to nonviolence, and nonviolence for us meant no violence against human beings. We didn't even speak to the workers. We had a police liaison who spoke to the police in each of our actions. Otherwise, we stood and held hands and sang peace songs and sang uplifting songs about justice and love and peace with our brothers and sisters and peace with the earth itself and prayers for healing for the earth. We had parties. We had pizza parties and kayaks going down the Pequoy Creek, where they were blasting through the bedrock of the bed of the Pequoy Creek so they could put the pipeline in there. And we did an action and kept them from working for over a day, where the workers stood on one side of the bank and we were just across the stream from them. We offered them pizza. We had our music blaring and we were just playing in the creek that day.
In the end, her organization completed over 25 nonviolent actions over 8 months, a time where over 60 members of the organization were arrested at least once, including both of her children, who seemed just as committed to the cause as their mother. Remarkably enough, her activism doesn't even stop at nonviolent civil disobedience. Here she is again.
Also, I started working for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, and they have been working for over 20 years in pushing for local rights to self-government. We tried to pass laws here in our local community that would say that, let's say, pipelines aren't allowed. So if we in our township passed a law that said transmission lines aren't allowed to come through our property, they do too much damage. So our township, our community says, no, you can't do this. That's illegal. The state and the federal laws preempt anything that the local community would want to do. So even though the state is required to protect the health and safety of communities, they have regulations that allow corporations to violate and destroy the health and safety of communities. And local communities don't have the legal right to pass laws to protect themselves above and beyond these limitations that the federal and state government put in place. And so we've been working, CELDEF, and I've been working with them to try and pass some laws in Harrisburg that allow local communities to have those rights. To say, yes, those regulations that the state and the federal government put in place are really, really important. But rather than being a ceiling that local communities can't pass laws beyond, that should be a floor, and that local communities should be able to pass laws that protect them even further than what those regulations state.
This work in particular has yielded tangible results. The Pennsylvania State Legislature is currently considering House Bill 2823, which would etch into law the ability for communities to legislate their own futures with respect to environmental issues. While talking with Melinda about her work, I was struck with the realization, this is the answer. This is the way forward in the larger fight for our Earth. The organization that she had helped create was cohesive, unified, and had an indomitable will to succeed. And it is these strengths that our society as a whole must tap into in order to find the will to make changes to our world order, changes that will be necessary to allow our planet to heal itself. However, Melinda and her colleagues are working against impossibly stacked odds, and they need help. So I had a bright idea. What if large NGOs devoted their power and resources to enabling these environmentalists to better complete their meaningful and directly impactful work, rather than working to maintain the half-baked concessions that are afforded to them currently? Now, thinking myself quite the environmental thinker, I posed the question to her. And as it turns out, my ambitions of maybe one day being blessed with a random iteration of environmental genius will have to wait. Melinda has had interactions with Big Green and is skeptical of their ability to act in the way I described.
One of the things we discovered, we worked a lot with Sierra Club. We had lawyers who worked with us and our lawyers to sue the DEP. And we were friends with a number of people who worked high up in the Sierra Club here in Pennsylvania. And they supported our work, but the institution for which they worked had limitations on what they could do and how they could be involved.
So, while the current iterations of the largest environmental NGOs won't be much help, I can't help but wonder if this reality of Big Green sponsorship isn't one that will take too much to achieve. While many Big Green entities have been compromised in their effectiveness recently due to essential mergers with big business, they by and large are made up of individuals concerned with the environment. A transition could occur if those individuals were convinced that they could have much more impact, even with less of a spendable budget, participating as enablers for community-based organizations. And while convincing nonprofit organizations to part with the majority of their funding seems like an unlikely proposition, it is quite plausible and requires fewer steps in order to be realized in comparison to many other strategies that are currently considered by environmentalists today. Such an approach could also possibly provide great boons to the cause of environmentalism through reaching out to communities that accepted fracking with open arms. While some will simply never be convinced, based on my experience from growing up in such a community, these people have had the wool begun to be pulled over their eyes by a government that is, in general, placed solidly in support of fracking, and then are completely propelled into the darkness of ignorance and misinformation by the industry itself. One resident described her and her community being placated by an informational presentation on fracking, even though they knew it was being given by an industry ambassador. The presentation was, of course, categorically untrue in almost every aspect. It simply outlined fracking as a safe and clean method of natural gas extraction that would give great economic benefits to the community. But in all of their minds, already softened up by the constant flow of pro-fossil fuel rhetoric being pumped into their ears by conservative media, it was enough to satisfy them. However, there is unquestionably still a place for environmentalism in these communities. All of the people that I interviewed described a deep connection to their land and the ecosystem in which they live, and if they are informed, assisted, and befriended by local environmentalists with the funds to protect that land, there may still be hope. Indeed, when one resident, who just happens to be my grandmother, was asked about whether or not she would be accepting of renewable energy alternatives to fracking, if they were presented to her, this is what she had to say.
I want what is best for our country, for our land, for our environment.
You heard the woman. She just wants the best. And if there are community-led organizations that fall under the umbrella of environmentalism doing good works for communities all across the country, it'll be pretty clear what the best is. Unfortunately, that's all we have for you today on the issue of fracking in the Ohio River Valley and its many impacts and implications. But before we part ways, I'll leave you with this statement. The boom of fracking in the United States and how it will be responded to by environmentalists might just be the first shot fired in a new battle for the American environmental conscience. Thank you for joining us on Environmentalism Now, and we hope you'll join us again next week. So long.